Nathan, you know, he wasn't really interested in paganism as it turned out. It was like, Nathan, I'm not interested in what you believe. I want to know what does it say on your ID card. And that's when it hit me that although religion absolutely is a matter of faith, and there are other aspects to it, fundamentally, at least when you talk about Egypt, one of the things that religion is a bureaucracy. Okay, and it is, there are aspects of religion that really, especially when you talk in sort of legal, constitutional, and political terms, really have an awful lot to do, not necessarily with when we think about religious freedom, we often think in terms of personal freedom of conscience and freedom from the state, but instead a lot of it is about how it is that we act socially, how it is that we treat each other, how family members treat each other, how different members of the society treat each other, and of course that's something that is absolutely woven into the social and political fabric in all different kinds of ways. So when you ask about social conduct, about political conduct, when you ask about family relations and education and so on, it naturally brings up issues of religion. So this then sort of brings me into the what. What is it that Arab constitutions have to say on the subject? Well, they say all kinds of things. Partly because of the way that they have evolved over the years. Constitutions sometimes have take a little bit sort I like to think, you know, we think of constitution writing as an act of invention when a nation sits down and defines itself, but actually most constitution writing is an iterative process, right? You take the last one and you add to it. So they have a little bit of a Christmas tree effect of, okay, well, we need a little bit of this or this problem, we had this problem last time. And so what has happened by accretion in the Arab world is a set of provisions that when read individually sort of make some sense, but you're not quite sure how they're all going to add up. So religious freedom, some kind of freedom of belief is absolutely routine. Ban on discrimination on the basis of religion is absolutely routine. An official religion, being Islam, is there absolutely routine. There are some constitutions that prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender, and then have a provision for Islamic personal status law prevailing. So, which is highly gendered. So how do you do both of these things at the same at the same time? There's often sources of law clauses, you know, most famous being Egypt's Article 2, the principles of the Islamic Sharia are the main source of legislation. There are moral provisions that are not necessarily specifically religion, but about the importance of the family and this sort of thing, or the importance of moral education in schools, that give sort of a paternalistic idea of what state authority is about in ways that would naturally be understood and practiced in a matter that is definitely informed by religious principles. And then there is something odd about Arab constitutions as well, or Arab the way that if you ever read a court decision that involves statutory or constitutional interpretation in the Arab world, it will use a phrase that sounds a little bit odd, at least odd to me. I mean, I don't read court decisions in other languages, so maybe it's routine, but it refers to the legislator. Right? If they want to find out what the purpose is, they say the legislator. There is a single act, and it's used in the singular, as if there is a single will that is writing the constitutional text. And so the idea that you could have tensions and contradictions within the Constitution is actually something that is rejected in prevailing forms of statutory and legal interpretation in the Arab world. The legislator cannot contradict himself. So the phrase itself, the legislator, doesn't know, it doesn't come from Shafi'i or Hanbali. Jurisprudence comes from Rousseau, as far as I know. But it's sort of the basic idea that there is a single will that lays down the basis for the legal and constitutional order. The result of, I think, what I tried to do in the paper towards the beginning of the period is sort of sum up what I think all these constitutional clauses mean in practice, and there is some similarity among Arab states in this. I mean, there's a great deal of uniformity is too strong a word, but there's a great deal of commonality. There are some outliers like Saudi Arabia that wouldn't go this far, but the model constitutional clause that I'm about to read is a little bit flippant in tone, but I think could fit for probably about three-quarters of the Arab states, and it goes like this. Believe whatever you wish. Some beliefs you shouldn't talk about. When it comes to practicing religion, you have freedom. I'm paraphrasing now from my paper, you have absolute freedom to choose any one of a menu of state-recognized faiths, or rather have your parents, especially your father, pick for you. Changing your mind about your faith can get complicated, sometimes dangerous, especially if it's away from Islam, but we would prefer not to specify the consequences in clear legal form. and that's true, actually. You know, it just, you go try going to the Ministry of Interior in Egypt and saying, I used to be a Muslim and I am no longer. And you will not get a clear legal response. You'll get a clear response, but it will not be legal. Changing within sects of the same religion is generally much easier. Sometimes you can be allowed to switch sects simply to change the provisions of the family law that governs you, but sometimes we will obstruct that path. The state is there to help you, your family, and your community practice your religion within certain bounds. It's also there to help ensure that it's taught to your children. When you marry, divorce, or inherit, you will do so according to the way that state officials interpret and apply the teachings of your own religious community. They have generally consulted with scholars versed in your religion in coming up with their interpretations. The state favors the religion of Islam by sponsoring a significant role for the religion, as state-supported religious officials define it, in public life. And the state takes it as a duty to protect Islam as a religion deserving rights and respects. But other recognized religions obtain protection as well. So you can understand with this kind of idea, why was it, what I was telling my friend, Nathanism absolutely made no sense. I mean, sort of mix and match, and this is kind of what I believe, and this is what I feel today, and this is how, you know, my parents raised me. This kind of made no sense. The question was, what recognized faith? Religion is, in that sense, a juridical category, almost as if, you know, he'd ask me what state had issued my driver's license, and I started telling him my favorite color of car, or something like this. There was a juridical aspect of the question, which I was completely oblivious to. So that's kind of the prevailing constitutional formula. What is interesting about it, I think, is that you can, when I talk about kind of religion being partly a matter of practice, and being understood as social and political practice, of course you can certainly anchor that within prevailing understandings of Islam and very old understandings of Islam. But you know, and this is of course all, you know, done all the time. You know, Islam has no recognition or separation between church and state, and this sort of thing. But what I think we really have to come to grips with is the fact that, and this is where I get to where it came from. Actually, the set of institutional arrangements and the reason why it is done in this particular pattern really is anchored not in 7th century Arabian Peninsula, but is anchored much more in the historical experience of Arab states late 19th and early 20th century, and it has to do with very specific things that happened with state formation, with imperialism, with the way that the Ottoman Empire governed and then broke down, and so on. And it leads to a whole series of peculiarities that have very little basis in Islamic doctrine. All right, why is personal status law the bastion of Islamic law? It has nothing to do doctrinally with Islamic law. There is no category of personal status law. Right? It had to do, the phrase personal status law was invented by the French in Algeria and then exported and adopted by states elsewhere. In the region, there are other sorts of particularities as well. One which you will read in the news today is Mohamed Morsi, the former president of Egypt, who has just issued a death sentence, provisional on, is being sent to the Mufti. Now, why do you have an Islamic official come in? The reason you have an Islamic official come in, the reason it gets referred to the Mufti, is because it used to be that the rulers of Egypt under the Ottoman Empire had to get the approval of an Ottoman official. And so as really an assertion of sovereignty, an Ottoman legal official, in the late 19th century, the Egyptian government essentially trying to not full sovereignty from the Ottomans, but with the support of the British, who were then occupying the country under nominal Ottoman sovereignty, insisted that it go to the Mufti instead. And so the reason the Mufti has got this real political hot potato is to demonstrate that Egypt is not really governed by the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is long gone. The Mufti's role in that particular way remains, and he is allowed to review the death sentence. not simply on the basis of a review of the evidence in the case, but also on whether or not it is consistent with Islamic law. So you have this kind of weird insertion of it that is under, that I think can only be understood in a historical terms, but again, in recent historical terms. And often, a lot of the ways that the personal status law, for instance, got settled the way it did, had to do with the role of minorities within the region, the way in which European states sometimes protected those minorities. It had to do sometimes with the capitulations with states who were anxious to avoid giving a license for European states to intervene domestically in their own legal borders, and therefore sort of wanted to give some kind of protection to minorities. The reason, the way in which religion is bureaucratically structured in most Arab states, they show some strong commonalities, has to do with enormous period of state expansion in the late 19th, early 20th century, depending on where you're going. So most Arab states have something called a Ministry of Religious Affairs. They very often will administer waqfs. They will administer zakat. It's not necessarily the only way that you can practice zakat, but there will often be sort of state-mandated or state-supported agencies in order to do it. They run sometimes an awful lot of the mosques in the country. In virtually every Arab state, you have some kind of state-mandatory religious education, and what that means is that the religion that gets taught to children is something that is devised by officials within the Ministry of Education. So this is the idea that education is a state function, or the assertion that education is a state function, it really begins in the 19th century and then picks up, of course, with vengeance in the 20th century. Same sort of thing with broadcasting. There's a heavy religious content to broadcasting that gets initiated when you have essentially state-owned or state-licensed broadcasting. The idea of having a state mufti, again, is a generally 19th or 20th century thing. So what you have is a whole set of institutional arrangements which bear some similarity from one Arab state to the next, for the most part, and that I think are rooted, therefore, in a very specific historical experience. Now, what does this mean? I think you have this kind of conception of religious freedom. What does it mean that you have it sort of written in these kind of strange and kind of hybrid constitutional formulas? let me go back. This is conclusion of my paper. I think the formulas devised a century and a half ago, and I trace them in the Ottoman Empire, Tunisia, and Egypt, have gone through many permutations, but the essentials remain unchanged. And so long as religion is protected in this way, given recognition in specific realms like personal status and education and so on, it'll be necessary for the political order to decide what is a religion and what isn't. Who speaks for a religious community? What religious issues will be given some kind of constitutional insulation? This very process involves the state in religious affairs and folds religion into the state apparatus. Now, there's protection aplenty. There's protection for states. There's protection for religious communities. There's protection for religious leaders. There's protection for Islam. There's protection for specific rights and freedoms. And to some extent, there's protection for individual freedom of conscience. There's a much stronger communal emphasis, but there is some protection for freedom of conscience. But the result is neither liberal nor secular, but it's a conception of religious freedom that involves a complicated intertwining of religion and the state that leads it to very, very difficult to unravel. And I thought, in closing, I'd sort of trace this in two particular areas, just to illustrate kind of the possible significance of one of which I mentioned in the paper and one of which I do not. What I mentioned in the paper is what this does with minority religious communities, right? You would think that for many people who are not part of the state declared official religion, what they would really press for very, very hard would be some kind of civic conception of citizenship, right? We are all the same. And some do. But you have this this odd event, which I mentioned in the paper, 1955, the Egyptian state abolishes all separate personal status quo, Christians and Muslims. And the Christian leadership in all of its different sects, they cannot agree on anything in Egypt, Catholics, Protestants, and so on, decide they are going to cancel Christmas that year. The reason that they are so upset, of course, is because what this did was to provide a level of insulation protection for different Christian communities, and a very strong level of legal protection. It meant that when you were a Christian, you were under, in other words, as a member of a state-enforced and state-supported religious community. So the idea that you would have some kind of uniform citizenship was very, very threatening to the Christian leadership. And that is the case to this day. You have very interesting struggles right now within the Egyptian Christian community. Essentially, what I refer to in the paper is kind of battles between weekday Christians and Sunday Christians, right? The Christian community in Egypt, to the extent that it is a worship-based community, you know, expressed in church, the people who speak for it is the church hierarchy, and the church hierarchy is very much invested in the constitutional formula that I've described. What it doesn't say how very much is in issues of normal everyday discrimination, exclusion from certain spheres of public life, and so on. The Christian leadership, the church leadership, is very happy with this arrangement. You're now beginning to get some pushback from sort of the laity in a very interesting kind of dynamic like that within Egypt. But so the constitutional formula not simply protects Islam, but also deeply affects the structure of authority within non-majority communities. There's a second thing that it does as well, and this is something I want to kind of which I sort of hint at in the paper, but I think it's probably most interest to political scientists who study authoritarian politics. I think there's a tendency within the discipline of political science, when we approach authoritarian politics, we tend to focus very, very much on the authority and the intention of the individual ruler, right? So why is it that an authoritarian ruler would allow for elections, allow for parliament, allow for an independent judiciary? Political scientists like to ask this question about different spheres. And I think one thing that we often forget to do as a result is understand just the distinction between state and regime, which should be basic to political scientists, and the extent to which, according to the constitutional formula that I've described, religion is woven into every single aspect of the state. So let me just take one example of how this operates. And that's El Azhar. I was about to say El Azhar University, but of course El Azhar is much more than a university. El Azhar is a huge bureaucracy. Right? When you're talking about El Azhar, people will sometimes talk about El Azhar being co-opted. What they generally tend to mean is that the Sheikh of El Azhar is traditionally basically a political appointee. If that's going to be less the case in the future, it's going to be generated instead by a senior ulama council within El Azhar. A senior ulama council in Al-Azhar that was appointed by the current Sheikh of Al-Azhar. So you've got this great arrangement where the Sheikh appoints his friends who then appoint him. It's a self-perpetuating structure, which will make it, I think, much more autonomous within the Egyptian state than anybody realizes today. So you talk about, some people refer to meaning the Sheikh. But outside of that, you've got an entire kind of faculty of Al-Azhar that is a lot more diverse than the Sheikh that the Sheikh had lose control of. You've got Al-Azhar, I would describe as almost a brand name, and I hope I'm not being too flippant there if there are any Azharis that are offended by this. But there's a way in which, if you're a graduate of Al-Azhar, that you dress and that you kind of present yourself and that you can invoke, you know, this is the Azhari way of doing things. And it gives individual scholars kind of a license in which to kind of talk and present their own interpretations as somehow coming from a tradition that is seen as Egyptian, centrist, Islamic, as if those terms were all coterminous. Okay, so it's a way of that individual religious officials can present themselves. It's also a nationwide network of primary and secondary schools that is. I think about something like 10% of the Egyptian school population goes to Azhar school, something like that. And of course, it's a university. And it's a university that, while the senior leadership of Al-Azhar is very much on board, say with the post-2013 order, you go to the campuses themselves, and it's sort of like a little bit more of a brotherhood-friendly zone. So it creates, I would say, not simply, I mean, if we talk about LSR being co-opted, there is some sense in which that is the case if you look at specific officials and specific things that come out of LSR. But it's also basically pulled at a very religiously adherent part of the society into the Egyptian state apparatus itself and creates real problems for authoritarian rulers who suddenly discover that when they've kind of swallowed El-Azhar, they've taken within their own ranks, for instance, a student body that is making, that is at this point probably the most, one of the most problematic parts of, for the new regime to dominate. It creates, I mean, in other countries you'll find, for instance, you know, in Jordan you will hear this all the time, that the educational system is something that is essentially brotherhood infiltrated. What it does when the state says we will handle religious education, yes, it gets to decide what goes in, but it also folds within its own ranks a whole army of people who are trained essentially in religion and have their own understanding and one that might sometimes deviate from that is most convenient for the rulers at a particular moment. So it makes these states much, much, much more complex entities, and sometimes states that offer privileged points of entry for specific religious points of views in ways in which I think if we understand all authoritarian politics as the extension of the all political structures in an authoritarian order as extensions of the will of the ruler, things that we will just completely miss. And so there will be an aspect of kind of religion-state relations, which certainly is not liberal, it's not secular, and it's certainly not democratic, but it's an awful lot more interesting, and there's an awful lot more variety in contestation that is not going to be visible if you simply focus on this as being an authoritarian system, period.
Nearly 15 minutes for questions.
Do you want to look after the question yourself?
Yeah, sure.
So who's got the first question?
So I've read about those fascinating. And when you read out your description of what these Arab constitutions tend to look like, I heard a lot of examples which are familiar to me from Southeast Asia, as well as the majority countries as well. But they're not all exactly the same, but they're very similar. So why would they be similar if this is really rooted in Ottoman history, or the experience of independence from there. Now, there's possible.